Real Great Adventures of Me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog. Terrific!
I'm Tom Terrific, greatest hero ever. Terrific is the name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and Tom's ever faithful companion.
And you better, by God, believe it, or by Odin, or by Thor, because here I is, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker this afternoon, right here in north central Indiana. Usually I get this show out by about 10 o'clock in the morning, maybe 9 o'clock in the morning, but I goofed around today and didn't get it out, so we're going to be a little later. No, doesn't make any difference to you, I don't think, as long as you get it today, right? Well, it's an overcast day here, cool, in the 50s today, and it is the 27th of October. We're almost through with this month. Believe me, if you're going to do it in October 2015, you better do it, because you'll never get another chance. You've only got a couple of days to set the world on fire, man. You still got time to get out here to our weapons of mass destruction, used equipment yard, and we're closed, but we'll, if you got enough money in your pocket, we'll open up for you and get you one of those real destructive items like we bought from ISIS, yeah. And they stole them from the U.S. government, Uncle Sammy. And it's about time to put a little money in the envelope and get it off for your November shows to P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And you do that, and we'll be real happy here, and you'll allow me to live in the lap of splendor that I've always wanted to live in. Not. But to be perfectly honest, I'm as snug as a bug in a rug in my little one-bedroom house out here in the boonies where, well, there's a lot of people see me because there's all these cars that go by every day, but they don't see me because I'm behind a wood barrier, and I'm watching them with cameras all the time to make sure they behave. Well, let's get into it and see what the hell's going on out there. It's all good news as far as I'm concerned. The black KKK's gone crazy in Chicago as usual. What have they had? Six murders that they know of over the weekend. And I'm almost positive they were all black on black. So you got to hand it to our friends in the black community for taking care of business. Yeah, the black KKK. I told you yesterday about that Jew over in Israel who took his light aircraft, his big kite, flew himself over the border into ISIS land and joined up with ISIS. At first they were thinking that he went down accidentally, and they were going to send the Israeli army in there to get him, but they found out that he was volunteering to fight for ISIS, this Jew, and so Bibi is going crazy. He's going to get him. We're going to take his citizenship away from him. They're still going on and on about the Grand Mufti of Palestine. He was a buddy of Adolf Hitler, and I got a lot of stuff on him, and actually, B.B. told the truth as far as I'm concerned. Mufti was, the Grand Mufti was as close as peas in a pod with Adolf Hitler and agreed 100% on the Jews. And if he didn't agree with Hitler throwing them into camps, I'd be very surprised. So I don't see why people are getting so shook up. Just read what the Grand Mufti said at the time. I've got the stuff in my library here, and But everybody's climbing all over BB. I can think of many reasons to climb over BB, but that's not one of them. The Grand Mufti would have gassed every Jew he got a hold on, because I've read his attitude towards the Jews. He just didn't have enough Zyklon B, so he left it up to Uncle Adolf. You know, all you deniers out there, get off my back. Well, let's see if I can dig up some real dirt for you today, boys and girls. Get down there in the gutter and dig, man.
And happy birthday, Kimberly Jean. Okay, you want to know something else the Republicans are doing to screw poor people and working class people in this country? Healthcare co-ops are closing. Now, what's a healthcare co-op? Well, I'll get to that in a second. About a third of these alternative health insurers that were created under the Affordable Care Act, they were designed to spur competition, drive prices down so that people could afford insurance. They're shutting down about a third of them. The three largest health insurance co-ops are among that number. Only 14 are left. Now, the co-op insurers were intended to challenge the dominant companies, the big companies that have considerable power to dictate prices. And the fact that these co-ops are closing is leaving about 500,000 customers desperate to find health insurance for next year. A co-op that served Iowa and Nebraska closed in February. And according to the New York Times, at a time when the insurance industry, is experiencing a wave of consolidation with giants like Anthem and Aetna planning to buy their smaller rivals, that's what you do. You buy a smaller company, take its assets, fire people, keep the insurance policies, and you have all sorts of number increases of people going unemployed. Not to mention people who can no longer afford the insurance because your company decides to raise it. This is why we need affordable care. That's what we have. This Affordable Care Act, what we need is single payer. But don't hold your breath for that one. Now, the failures include co-ops in New York, Colorado, Kentucky, and South Carolina. And the shuttering of these are startup companies, by the way, and the shuttering of them amounts to what could be a loss of nearly $1 billion in federal loans provided to them to help them get started. You see what the Republicans do? The co-ops were created, to give you a little history, were created as a concession to Democrats who really wanted health care to be single payer, and since it wasn't going to be, they wanted the health care law, to include a government-run plan as an alternative to private insurers. Remember that? Remember the co-ops? It wasn't talked about too much because it was, so socialist. But remember? I do. They faced significant hurdles from the start. The Republican-controlled Congress slashed their initial funding from $6 billion down to $2 billion. And more recently, the Republican rats restricted the Obama administration's ability to help insurers with unexpectedly large costs in the first few years of the new exchanges by taking away money. See, the Republicans have been telling people from the very beginning, the rat bastards who vote for them, forget the president. That's symbolic. Vote for us into the Congress. We'll stop this madness. They sure are, aren't they? Former Senator Kent Conrad, North Dakota Democrat, who proposed the co-ops, said they were, quote, sabotaged. Conrad said those who wanted to kill them, Republicans and competing insurance companies, just step by step took actions to subvert them and assure they would have an extraordinarily difficult time surviving. So the people who were counting on the co-ops to get health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, subsidized by the government, very cheap, sorry. You have a disease. You need to have your kidneys checked. Sorry. Time to die. Republicans want you gone. Sorry. That's just the way it goes. You know, those Republicans are fiscally responsible. They're going to cut this kind of fat out of the budget. The Obama administration says it's doing what it can. The chief executive of the federal insurance marketplace, the co-ops, said that Sylvia Burwell, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, considers the co-op program a priority. But priority or not, there's nothing she can do or he can do or anyone can do as long as these vermin Republican cult members are in charge of the country's purse strings. They can take away anything they want to, and they are. Import-export bank that provides jobs, screw it, get rid of it. Health insurance co-ops that provide insurance, low-cost insurance for people who can't afford it, screw it, get rid of it. Supplemental nutrition programs, screw it, get rid of it. Food programs for pregnant women and little kids, to hell with them, get rid of it. The startups were the boards of directors on these startups were consumers. They weren't corporations. That's the reason they're being beaten into the ground now. And the co-ops tried at the beginning to sell some of the lowest cost plans that would put downward pressure on prices. You know where that would go, right? These capitalist sons of bitches in the insurance industry, the biggest scam on earth. Oh, no. So they went to their whores in the Congress and they said, kill it. Well, how do we kill it? Cut off the money, morons. Oh, okay. Yes, boss. The co-ops offered one of the two least expensive mid-range insurance plans in more than half the counties where they operated this past year, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, especially in rural areas that have historically suffered from a lack of competition and therefore had to deal with high prices. But the co-op's low prices left a lot of them in a less than enviable position. If you don't have a huge cash flow like the insurance companies do, the big insurance companies, so they can pay their executives millions of dollars a year, which has nothing to do with health or curing illness, but everything to do with continuing to support the 0.1%. If you're not a big company, well, how are you going to survive? Without the necessary financing from the government to keep them afloat, they're going to go under. And they are. And that closes another chapter in providing affordable health care, health insurance to American citizens. It never stops. Ever. We'll be right back.
Well, there's some skinny on the insurance situation. I want to tell you something. I don't like either party. But I'm going to tell you something. The Democrats, when they do something, they're pretty much out in the open about it. They say, we're going to do it. If you don't like it, screw you. Yeah. Or when there's corruption, usually it comes out and say, oh, yeah, we're corrupt. I'm a homo. I'm out of the closet. So what? And I can begrudgingly respect that. But the Republicans, I never realized until the last 10 years, maybe 15, how rotten these sons of bitches are. Now, if the working class would have ever wanted to really maintain themselves in this country instead of leaving the Democrat Party to the blacks and all the non-whites, they should have stuck in there and loaded it up with every white working person they could get and fought it out with the non-whites and kept the Democrat Party. But they've gone off into the weeds over the slogans of the Republican Party over hot button issues for the churches and everything. But the Republicans are so goddamn sneaky. And behind it all, you know, shipping the jobs out of the country. They're always worried about money and cutting off programs, but do they ever say anything about cutting the war budget? Not a goddamn thing about cutting the war budget. And I'm telling you, I wouldn't support or vote for anybody that doesn't say we got to cut that goddamn war budget in half. I mean, and the media doesn't hold their feet to the fire. None of them do, except like RT. Got to go to RT to get them, and they hold their feet to the fire. But the public doesn't. You know, they say, well, we don't like war. Well, how come you vote for guys every time or all the time that are wanting to give more and more weapons, build more and more weapons, and enrich the arms makers and everything else to get white people killed and anybody else they can kill in the process? Around here, I mean, they still think the Republican Party shit don't stink. And it's absolutely amazing how rotten and how outlawish this party. Now, my local congressman that I ran a write-in candidacy against him, or he was running at the same time I was, he sends me out this bullshit every couple of months, and he never talks about hard issues. It's always, I defended this or I did that, and yeah, I'm against abortion or something like that. He never talks about the war budget, because there's not one guy, one Republican, or there may be one or two, that's got the guts to talk about the military-industrial complex. And here you got killing all these programs for insurance, or killing it. You know, the right wing never seemed to understand, and I was telling them this years ago, the biggest number, the largest number of people on welfare in this country are whites. And the largest number of people receiving federal benefits in most cases have been whites. And not and then the Republicans would say, well, they're all lazy. Get a job. Get your hair cut. And we all know that at least they finally learned after 2007, 2008, that massive numbers of white people were on the street, and they're still on the street. They're not lazy. How can you be industrious when they ship your job over to the gooks? And still, the white working class doesn't hold the Republican Party's feet to the fire, and the National Chamber of Commerce and all those people, and the National Association of Manufacturers. They still don't do it. Well, what can you do to wake people up like that? Well, you're not going to wake them up, because they have to suffer. They have to get their face rubbed right into the shit before they'll do anything. And even then, most of them won't do anything. That's why the so-called democracy bullshit has been a sham ever since the beginning. Number one, it's not a democracy at all, to where everybody is voting and giving their opinion, and they ask their opinion on major issues. Nobody asks you about your major issues. They got some polling companies. Now, you don't have any idea who these people really are and who they're talking to. They always come out with supporting the system, unless it's against the white racist. White racism, oh boy, then there's no, right out there, run right out there. It's unbelievable. It's like this on the news last night in Chicago. No, this was in South Bend, which is only about 40 miles from me. Some guy, nigger, shot a nigger, and this big fat black gal says, well, we got to do something. This can't go on. Well, of course, I could tell her it's going to go on as long as there's black people in that neighborhood. It's going to go on. And I hear them do that all the time. Well, we got to do something about this. Well, round up these hot shots and run them out of town, or oh, heavens to Betsy, don't lynch him, because that would be very unkind. Now, that information on the insurance came from our the filthy, rotten, progressive side of the fence. Like I say, I pick my information from where I can get it. I'm not like the right-wing dumb conservatives. They got to have it strictly right-wing. Got to come from the right wing. And that filters down from the conservative, neocon side of the political party, the Republican Party. So the white race, as far as white racialism, is never going to get out of this rut if they stick to conservatism, because it's not the only thing conservative about it, it's a con. Conservative means you want to save things. You want to save your way of life. You want to save your culture. You want to save your race. These people that run around calling themselves conservatives, they're not, they're cons, all right, but they're not conservatives. Just like liberal lost its meaning years ago, then conservative lost its meaning too. Well, let's see if I can dig up some more shit for you. I like to dig up the shit. I was laying there in bed last night thinking about this deal over in the Middle East, and all of a sudden these hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people invading Europe. I got to thinking about it, since I always think there's something behind everything that happens. Things don't just happen. Well, we know that generally what happened was American military-industrial complex went tear-ass and all over, actually helping the so-called terrorists. They're not terrorists, it's guerrilla warfare. Terrorism is just a hot button they always use. But these planners in the Pentagon got to know that hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people are going to die when you do that. You can't put all these troops in a country and massive weapons and aircraft bomb at everybody without destroying the living habitat. In fact, they seem to concentrate on the living habitat, homes and so forth. And till at one point, they throw up their hands and flee the country. So now that we've bombed the shit out of everything in the Middle East, except Israel, they're all fleeing. Now, just like I think 9/11 was not a direct setup, I think it was something that once it happened, the powers that be are already with a plan to take advantage of it. And I think what's happening in Europe right now is, it's happening obviously, but there's a plan to take advantage of it. And what they're going to do? They're going to wipe out the Euro state. And in a lot of ways, that's probably good. And be going back to more factionalism and nationalism and so forth, which you would think would be good, and it could work out to be good. But the question is, why are the forces that be, the money people, really wanting this to happen? Because it's obviously to break up the Euro government. So that, I don't know whether you've thought about that, but I have. Things don't just happen. There's reasons for it. Now, the only thing that could change that is if the United States backs off in the Middle East, gets out of there, and leave things go back to somewhat normal. And sure, there are going to be factions and groups fighting each other, but it'll be manageable by people like Assad and people like that. You may not like Assad. They seem to have liked him fine for a long, long time. The whole family, we love Assad. And all of a sudden he was bad, just like Gaddafi. He became a friend of the U.S. and they killed him. So you have to look beyond what you see just on the TV screen. Why? Why is this? And how does this fit into the overall situation? And it works, it's going on here too with population change. So think about it. Who's benefiting by all this? the United States is not really benefiting because we're bankrupting ourselves with the military-industrial complex, massive debt. So what's that all about? People in high position, they know what's going on. Don't let them bullshit you. They know what's going on. So just, you're going to see the Euro government break up into little pieces, and there's going to be anarchy breakout in Europe. And are they preparing the way for a strong man or many strong men to take over in Europe? Is that what they're out to do? People they can really control better? That this crop of leaders in Europe are not tough enough, not ruthless enough? Is that what's going on? Are we looking at another creation of a Adolf, for good or for bad? And usually these things turn out to be bad, even though they sound pretty good. Like Uncle Adolf sounded real good in the beginning, but at the end, oh shit, what did we do? So think about it. They're going to break it up. Why did they want to break it up? Well, let's keep watching and listening, and we'll figure it out.
The newest screed against the Palestinians, saying that it was actually them or their leaders that were in charge or that caused the Holocaust.
Yeah, we had that. We talked about that the other night. That the
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's all right. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem back in the 20s apparently. Had a meeting with Hitler, and according to Netanyahu, it was at his instigation that Hitler opened up the death camps. Now, both Angela Merkel, the prime minister of Germany, and professors at Hebrew University in Israel, they all have come out and said that Netanyahu is out of his damn mind.
Of course, that will be the party line. You think they're going to admit it? Look, the Grand Mufti was up to his ass, and I'm going to have to dig out my books on that stuff, because he was up to his ass with Hitler, and he was, they had whole divisions of Arab SS troops. I mean, a lot of the Aryanists don't want to talk about that, but Hitler was recruiting lots and lots of those Arabs into the SS. And the feeling was, all he said was, look, Adolf, if you're going to ice them, that's great. We're all for you. Or wink, wink, nod, nod. Look at Iran. It was so Persia. It was so enthralled with Hitler that they changed their name to Iran. I mean, come on. And is there any love in that particular process for the Jews? No. Those Arabs down there, a whole lot of them, and the Grand Mufti included, wished nothing but bad on the Jews. And these people tickle me. Oh, no, that's ridiculous. That wouldn't have happened. Well, actually, they'd be better off to stick to the party line that they did want it to happen. And, Bibi is a ruthless son of a bitch, but sometimes he's right.
Some incredibly hateful, vicious leaders that if they were heads of countries any place on earth, the United States would have no more supported them than supported any despotic government that treats people like the Palestinians like they are so much dirt. It's just incredible, and we keep supporting it. It's just unbelievable. Unbelievable, but it's happening every day.
And we continue to support them. It's just disgusting.
It is.
But anyway, my head explodes, and when I see things like this, I think of you and your show, and I go, oh my God, I need to talk to Mike right now because I want to throw something against the wall.
Yeah.
But you saved me from insanity knowing that there, or I should say you and your fellow truth seekers saved me, because knowing that there are others out there who actually have some sense.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you can after a while feel that you're the only one wandering around in the desert of sanity, and that perhaps you've taken a turn into where. But besides that, I wanted to talk to you about Hillary.
Well, old Tommy's asleep at the switch. I forgot to get into our pessimist guide to history for the last couple of days, so we're going to get back into it now. In the year 1204, the sack of Constantinople, urged on by the Venetians, who had supplied them with chips, the French armies of the Fourth Crusade diverted from their intended goal, defeat of the Muslims in the Holy Land. See, there you go again. Instead, they succumbed to avarice, making a deal to restore a deposed Byzantine emperor in exchange for the riches of Constantinople. Religion and money, boys. The Crusaders took Constantinople in a Christian way, of course. Capital of the Byzantine Empire without resistance in July 1203, and restored the deposed emperor. When the people of Constantinople realized, however, that their emperor had agreed they would submit to the Pope, they practiced Eastern Orthodoxy and give the Crusaders their riches. They rebelled and re-imprisoned him. In March 1204, the Crusaders again attacked Constantinople. These armies of the whites of Europe running all over the Middle East looking for the bones and crosses. Jesus, what a bunch of fools. In March 1204, the Crusaders again attacked Constantinople, this time with a vengeance, setting fire to the city and leaving more than one quarter of it in ashes. They ransacked the Church of St. Sophia, ripping jewels and gold from the altar, and looted sacred relics to sell in Europe. Thousands of fine art masterpieces were stolen by the Phoenicians. Now remember, the Venetians also were the sort of the origins of the big bankers in Europe. Even the plays of Sophocles and Euripides, up until then complete, were mutilated and ruined. See, they spread this Christian love all over the place, man. The Crusaders created their own government and so-called Latin Empire of Constantinople, which they ruled. Once again, under the guise of Christianity, the Crusaders act like barbarians. No, they acted worse than barbarians. The barbarians, they just took. They didn't use religion as an excuse. 1209 to 1229, Christians against Christian, the Albigensian Crusade. After more than a century of crusades against the Muslims in the Holy Land, the church in 1208 preached its first crusade against fellow Christians. That's the way it goes. If they can't find some other group to fight and kill, they'll turn on each other. That's why I don't feel real safe around the Midwest anymore with all these whack job Zionist Christians around here. The heretical Albigensians in southern France, the Albigensian or Cathar movement, had spread throughout France's Languedoc region and had been gained the support of the noblemen there. But the movement aroused opposition of the church by denouncing church corruption, advocating a strict ascetism, denying the reality of the body. How's that going to work out for you, denying the reality of the body? And rejecting the Old Testament, baptism, priesthood, and sacraments of the Roman Church. Well, that would have been a start, getting rid of the Old Testament. It should be banned today off the bookshelves anyplace. It's a porno book. It's a genocidal book. It's everything bad. In fact, like the guy, the author says, the Bible, the devil's book. If I believed in the devil, I'd believe he's correct. And he didn't mean it, I don't believe, but he understood it. A long struggle to wipe out the heresy by peaceful means came to an end with the assassination of a papal legate in Toulouse after he had excommunicated the feudal lord Count Raymond VI for sympathizing with the Albigensians. Pope Innocent III, blaming Raymond for the murder, called for a full-scale crusade against the sect. That's what I call Christian love. For the most part, noblemen from the north answered the call, turning the crusade into what amounted to an invasion of southern France by noblemen from the north. Isn't religion wonderful? In June 1209, can you imagine you're trying just to, you got a little farm out there in France someplace, you're just trying to live your life, till the fields, feed your cows, milk the cows, things like, take them to market. Just want to be left alone. Here come these crazy-ass people. Armies trudging through your fields and tearing up your corn and killing your animals and eating them and everything. And that's the history of the world everywhere. Not just there in France. In June 1209, an army of mercenaries led by the northern French barons massed for their campaign to slaughter the heretics. Jesus. I don't think I would have lasted very long. Meanwhile, Raymond declared his penitence and joined the crusade himself. At Béziers, the crusade slashed their way through the streets, slaughtering everyone in their path. A crusader who asked how he should separate the heretics from the faithful Catholics was told, "Kill them all. The Lord will know well who is his." Catholics and Cathars alike tried to take refuge in the churches, but the undaunted crusaders went in and massacred them anyway. You know, the history of man is mayhem and murder. The atrocities only got worse as the crusaders ravaged town after town. Crusaders ripped out the tongues and eyes of defeated, dragged them with horses and hacked them to pieces with swords. Christian love. In Lavaur in 1211, the crusaders tried to hang 80 knights from one rope. When the rope broke, they slit the throats of their victims instead. Meanwhile, crusaders also tried to force the heretics to recant their beliefs and pledge allegiance to the Church of Rome. Hundreds refused, preferring to burn themselves to death in massive bonfires. Oh boy. In 1226, French King Louis the ninth, led a massive new army into southern France to wipe out the last vestiges of the heresy. And in 1229, the long crusade finally ended with the almost total defeat of the Albigensians. "Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house." In 1212, fire burns London. Flames that started in the Church of St. Mary Southwark spread unchecked through London, destroying much of the city. Probably somebody firebombed the church. A great crowd of people were trapped on the wooden London Bridge when fire broke out at both ends. By the time the fire was extinguished, some 3,000 people had been killed. This was the second fire to destroy London. And here's my favorite. 1212, the Children's Crusade. Seized with religious fervor, born of the Crusades, thousands of children in Germany and France set out to conquer the Holy Land and retrieve the sepulcher of Christ. Two separate groups of children attempted to mount the Crusades, but like the true Crusades, the children tried to emulate. Both expeditions ended in disaster. How could it have been any other way? In Germany, during the spring of 1212, a 10-year-old boy named Nicholas began urging the children in his native Cologne to join him in a crusade to Jerusalem. I wonder what some of the Jews were thinking about at this time. Jaime, let's just get out of the road. Those fucking Christians are coming again. Don't make them mad. His enthusiasm for the cause was contagious. Soon thousands of children... Boy, this guy must have been a rock star. Soon thousands of children between the ages of 6 and 18 had disregarded their parents' pleas and left home to follow Nicholas to Italy, where they intended to board a ship bound for the Holy Land. Their numbers grew steadily as the children from every town they passed through became caught up in the quest. Nicholas' band eventually numbered 20,000, though many of the smaller and weaker children were unable to make it over the Alps, collapsing along the way from exhaustion and starvation. Most reached Lombardy, where they split up into several groups, though it is not known whether this was by design or by accident. The largest group of more than 7,000 arrived in Genoa on August 25th, but these children were forced to abandon their crusade because no ships were willing to take them to the Holy Land. I could see the captain of the ship saying, "You must be out of your fucking mind. Go home." Several of the children made their way to Rome to ask Pope Innocent III to release them from their crusading oaths, but the rest of the group simply scattered across Italy, exhausted, humiliated, and penniless. While Nicholas was leading his band of crusaders over the Alps, a similar movement was taking place in France. In June of that year, a French shepherd boy named Stephen claimed to have seen a vision of Christ, who handed him a letter to deliver to the King of France. They must have had marijuana in France. Stephen set off on his errand with zeal, and soon tens of thousands of enthusiastic children joined him. It was not long before the horde of children decided to carry Christ's mission to the Holy Land. Stephen's band of 30,000 eventually reached Marseille. Can you imagine living in one of these towns with 30,000 kids come marching through? Probably stealing everything they could get their hands on. Where it is popularly believed that two disreputable merchants, Hugh Ferris and William Porcus, offered them free passage to Syria. Oh, poor Syria. One medieval source reports the children set off for the Holy Land in 7 ships, but that a storm off the Isle of St. Peter dashed 2 of the ships against the rocks, where they sank with all aboard. The remaining 5 ships are said to have docked in Bougi in modern Algeria and Alexandria, Egypt, where the merchants sold the children into slavery. The Caliph al-Nazir supposedly bought 400 of them for himself, and the other children went to the Saracen princes or slave merchants. It was reported that 18 of the children were martyred by the Saracens, who attempted to make them renounce Christianity. As long as 18 years after the disastrous crusade, Meskhetmush of Alexandria supposedly still owned 700 of the crusaders, who were by that time full-grown men. Well, that's about all I can take for today. That gives you an example that these things are not taught in school. Maybe some in college, but you should read this stuff to your kids. Get them out of that idea of Jesus. Well, that's enough of that crap for today. We'll get back into it probably tomorrow. Religion dumbs you down, because if somebody came through town and said, "Hey, come with us." Well, why? Well, we're going to the Holy Land. We're going to march hundreds of miles and get on a ship and go over and fight these Muslims so we can find the cross of Jesus. Would you go? Well, if you were a true believer, you may do that. You know, thousands of them did. But anybody with a logical, normal mind would say, "Get the hell out of here." Well, they got enough confusion over there in Europe and all those countries, and now they got this so-called left wing that want everybody into everything, and, you know, fighting the right wing in the streets, and the cops are out there water cannons. So we got thousands of these North Africans coming in there, and we got the right wing and the left wing doing what they always want to do and fighting in the streets. And oh God, what a mess. What is it about this? Let's go into the streets, baby. We'll solve the problem, which hardly ever gets solved in the streets. I mean, whatever happened to, let's find the bastard behind all this and put him to sleep. Well, let's close out the show today by running a little bit of crosstalk off of RT. These guys, they really got the number of Washington and the military-industrial complex. They really got, and Obama, he's become a total joke to them, because Obama's not even handling the show anymore. He's sleeping on the couch.
Has acted boldly and within international law in Syria. But what can we expect next? Washington and its allies remain dumbfounded on how to react. What will prevail, reason and realpolitik or intensified proxy war? We truly face a moment of truth. To Crosstalk Syria, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Svoboda, here in Moscow. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in London, we cross to Alexander Mercuris. He's a writer on legal affairs and an analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much encourage you. Dmitry Bobich, on September 30th, Russia's bombing campaign started in Syria at the request of the Syrian government in Damascus. How has this changed foreign policy for Russia? And how is it changing the region? Russia's foreign policy first.
Well, I think it did change the Russian foreign policy, and I think it was a risk, but a calculated risk. Just note how passive suddenly the Ukrainian government has become. Mm. So this is one more reason to understand that this government is not independent, and that, in fact, it is distance managed by the United States. The United States is now more concerned with Russia's airplanes in Syria than with the situation in Ukraine.
Okay. Alexander, Dmitry Bobich probably brought up the most important word that I wanted to talk about in this entire program for the next 26 minutes. What are the risks involved? Because we've seen it working out quite well so far. Are we in the middle of the game? Still in the beginning? And let's talk about risks. Go ahead, Alexander, in London.
We are very much at the start of the game, in my opinion, and the great risk, the very big risk, is that people in Washington who are not happy with this situation at all are going to try and find or look for ways to escalate the conflict
Yes.
in order to make what the Russians are trying to do in Syria fail. And already we're hearing reports about more arms being shipped to the Syrian opposition, and more demands for transitions in Syria, political transitions that do not involve the Syrian government. And of course there's been an orchestrated media campaign against this entire operation.
Yeah.
So we are at the very start of this, and there is a serious risk that the conflict could escalate rather than move towards a resolution.
Mark, let me go to you. Worried about escalation?
Okay, what I'm worried about, the Western press will tell you lots of reasons why Russia is getting involved in Syria overtly, militarily, and almost none of them are accurate. Russia, like any government, when it does these things, has multiple reasons for doing so, and there's geopolitical reasons and so on. The number one, most important reason is Russia's national security. This is why they are involved in Syria. No matter which one of the 31 flavors of jihad that comes out yeah. on top in Syria, if the Syrian government fell, would be bad for Russia. The Islamic State has already declared war on Russia. They have claimed Russia's Northern Caucasus as a Caucasus emirate as part of their territory. ISIS franchise groups have already been involved in attempted terrorist operations that have thankfully been halted by Russian intelligence services in the North Caucasus, and perhaps attempted or plans for Moscow as well. Northern Syria is only 24 hours yeah. by jeep away
right. from Grozny
from southern Russia. So Russia sees this as a clear threat to their security, whether it's Al-Qaeda, whether it's the Islamic Army of Conquest or ISIS coming to power or any combination of the three, they recognize that this will destabilize not only the entire region, but present a very real destabilization and terrorist threat to Russia as well.
Okay.
They're going to fight it here rather than there.
But, you know, Dmitry, this is probably one of the things that Western politicians don't want to acknowledge, and they certainly will not tell Western publics, is that, you know, Russia will act in its own national interest. It started, it was invited legally under international law to go in and help protect the regime in Damascus. It didn't want it to fall. It wanted to work with the President Assad and the Syrian army to defeat these terrorists, all these terrorists, whatever flavor as Mark pointed out. But the United States cannot comprehend another country acting individually, unilaterally, without its consent to do something military on this scale.
Well, you are absolutely right. And there was an interesting article about this in Russia in Global Affairs, a foreign policy magazine published in Russia. The author is Chess Freeman, and he basically wrote that the United States, especially in the last 25 years, was not involved in diplomacy.
Right.
What the United States is doing is not diplomacy. It's either an open war or sanctions, or a threat of sanctions and a war. There is never a compromise. And I think the reason why Syria is so important, you know, if the United States agrees at a certain moment that we all need first to defeat the 31 flavor of jihad, and then we can talk about democracy in Syria, that would be a compromise. The first compromise in 25 years.
They can't do it, Dima. They can't.
If they can do it, then it is very dangerous.
Because the jihad is their tool of regime change.
But the problem is that, you know, the so-called Islamic State, we may consider this ideology outdated or based on myths, but they do want to rebuild the great caliphate that existed in the 8th century. And at the time, that caliphate included not just what is now the Russian North Caucasus and what used to be the Soviet Central Asia. It also included Spain. It included all of North Africa.
Right, right.
It included Turkey.
And the Balkans. Right.
And the Balkans. So basically, by agreeing not to notice all the 31 flavor of jihad in Syria, the United States is putting Europe at risk,
well,
not just Russia.
You know, Alex, you know, one of the things I think what the Americans find very extremely vexing in all of this is that prior to President Putin's speech at the General Assembly in New York, he and his diplomats worked very hard to work with regional players, talk to the Saudis, talk to the Israelis, talk to the Turks, talk to the Qataris, talk to everybody. I'm going back to what Dima Babic is talking about with diplomacy, because when Russia started out, it had all of its, if I can use the American term, had all of its ducks lined up. Under international law, it's sound here. And this gives me a little bit of hope that this entire project, this entire policy that they're pursuing in Syria will work out, because it's thought out from the beginning.
Well, it is thought out, and of course the Russians are continuing with their diplomacy. We had President Assad in Moscow, and on the very day that President Assad was in Moscow, Mr. Putin spoke by telephone to the King of Saudi Arabia, the King of Jordan, the President of Egypt, the President of Turkey. When does Mr. Obama ever speak to so many people in one day? Then we had another meeting shortly after between Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Kerry in Vienna with other people from other Arab states there. We've had the Israelis there. We've had all sorts of people contacting Moscow. Moscow speaking to everybody and doing so all the time. The Russians do not do war or diplomacy. They do war and diplomacy. They understand that the one has to complement the other. Now, I agree, that is absolutely necessary to make any chance of this succeeding. Unfortunately, it is not entirely up to the Russians whether it succeeds.
Yeah.
There is a threat from the other side, from Washington. Contrary to their own interests, I would add, and contrary to Europe's interests,
yeah,
as Dmitry Babich has rightly said, that there are some people in Washington whom I'm afraid are certainly angry enough and dangerous enough to seek a further escalation rather than to work with the Russians, yeah, to try and find a solution to this that might be the best solution for everybody.
You know, and Mark, you know, this is the second time Syria
where Russia and I was specifically Vladimir Putin has gone and pulled the chestnuts out of the fire for Barack Obama. And this is something that's unpalatable. I mean, he watching interviews with him on 60 Minutes, I mean, he doesn't even know how to respond. I mean, he's baffled and angry, which is all nice and fine, but that's not a policy. And as all of you have mentioned here, it's not even American foreign policy interest, not in European foreign policy interest, but they continue down this road. Every once in a while we hear, and we heard this from Kerry, is that we may have some of the players get together this week that's upcoming, but he made it very clear that he didn't want European powers there, which I thought was very, very interesting. Again, the U.S. needs to be hegemonic. It can't act or think any other way. Go ahead.
Yeah, what's become clear is that Obama is an incompetent lame duck prisoner of the own military foreign policy state, which he has supported in the early years of his presidency with a number of neocons like Nuland, Powers, and others who are part of his foreign policy team, as well as the deep state, the military, the intelligence. He has openly said as much, that the CIA basically cajoled and pressured him into sponsoring a program that trained 10,000 proxies.
Mark, have you ever come across a sitting president that says this while in office, that he's not in control of his foreign policy establishment?
And he said, I didn't really want to do it. This is incredible. Even further, during the UNGA speeches, the Daily Beast's national security editor, Nancy Yusuf, on Twitter was tweeting that the U.S. generals were listening to Obama's speech to try to figure out Obama's strategy with regards to ISIS. And this, the military, the intelligence, the Obama administration, they're not sleeping in the same bed anymore. Someone or multiples are sleeping on the couch, and I think it's Obama.
Well, I think it's understandable why they don't understand each other, because even from that CBS interview, you can see that Obama simply has wrong advice. He has wrong information. He called Yanukovych 2 years after the coup. He called him Putin's stooge. You know, I think
he forgot to mention the sitting president in Ukraine is an oligarch as well.
We've had exposés in Western mainstream newspapers, New York Times, Washington Post, showing that just like in the Bush administration, this wrong intelligence is being cooked. That you are having politicized intelligence that is handed to Obama, telling what either he or other people want to hear.
Yeah, that's exactly true, but this is the most dangerous thing, you know.
Let me jump in here. Gents, we're going to go to where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Russia's anti-terrorism efforts in Syria. Tia, the whole crux of this whole thing is it gets down to who's a terrorist and who isn't a terrorist, how you describe a terrorist, who's a rebel. This is the huge divide right now. And the Russians have made it very clear that when you have outside foreigners being paid as mercenaries, jihadists from whatever...
taxpayers.
Yes, okay. And then you have the Russian position, and basically if you are there on the soil of Syria, you are a legitimate target, and you will be targeted by Russian Air Force in working with the legitimate government, Damascus, President Assad. That's the big division right here. Can it be bridged?
Yeah. The Western media and governments have presented this completely wrong from before the beginning of the campaign. Putin made very clear his UN General Assembly speech when they initiated the operation that they were going after ISIS and other terrorist groups, not just ISIS.
He didn't promise just ISIS as it was floated in Western media.
As it was just said in Western media. And he said the only way to restore stability is to support the Syrian government and the army that is needed to take back territory from these terrorist groups. The Western media will try to sell you maps that present Russian bombing in Syria as mostly hitting non-ISIS rebels or anti-Assad rebels. What they're not telling you is who these anti-Assad rebels other than ISIS are, that they are Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, that they are the Islamic Army of Conquest, that they are the Jihadist Ahrar al-Sham. And then we get to the so-called FSA, the Free Syrian Army, which from British journalist Robert Fisk to Joshua Landis have said it's not a real organization. It's a loose branding.
They have mailboxes in Ankara and Langley, from what I understand. Okay. And as I've said on this program before, the Free Syrian Army, if you really want to get to know them, call John McCain and CNN, because they know where they are. Okay.
Do me a favor. Google this. Don't trust me. Google this for yourself, checking only Western mainstream media sources. The Free Syrian Army, beheadings, check. The Free Syrian Army, suicide bombings, check. The Free Syrian Army, liver eating, cannibalism, check. The Free Syrian Army, operating under the military command of Al-Qaeda, check. The Free Syrian Army was allied with ISIS before they were against them. Then they were with them.
And
then they were against
them. Then we're told that they will commit acts of terrorism against Russian officials and soldiers.
These are moderates. Moderates?
Okay, Dima, this is where the West, particularly the United States, can't let go of this, because they've invested way too much into it. And for them to admit that Vladimir Putin is right, this is something they can't stomach. It's a pride issue as well. This is one of the most unfortunate things here, is that it's a pride issue to say that they were wrong all along during the last 4.5 years. Oh. Assad said in the beginning, these are terrorists attacking the state, and you know what? They are.
The problem is that, again, we see the same phenomenon, returning to the old untruths. I can quote you the New York Times from 2013, you know, where Anne Barnard and Eric Schmidt, two New York Times reporters, they wrote that Syria is supplanting Pakistan as the main safe haven for jihadists. They were writing that the Free Syrian Army is not so strong, and you know, that the Islamist factions are much stronger than the so-called secularist ones. So it looked like the United States establishment acknowledged this. And now they're returning to their seemingly naive stance of 2012, when they said that there are no Islamists fighting us, just the secularists. The same thing, you know, this is the reason why I was stunned by Obama calling Yanukovych before the coup Putin's stooge. You know, it looked like that this idea that Yanukovych was Putin's stooge was dismantled by the U.S. media back in 2005, 2006, when, despite the first Orange Revolution, Yanukovych started to mobilize his support. Then they said that Yanukovych represents certain business circles in Ukraine. He is not Moscow's puppet. And now we hear from Mr. Obama, 10 years after that, the same old wrong information.
Okay, I'd like to go to Alex in London. Alex, what is it going to take for the West to change its position, to get on the right side of history? Because the Russian government has made it very clear that it's going to defend and protect the government in Damascus. Iran has done that. Even Iraq is getting on board. Jordan's getting on board. When will the other powers, particularly the United States and its allies, get on board at least to take care of the terrorist issue first, and then work on whatever transition that everyone can reach to? Go ahead, Alex.
I think public opinion will have to play a very big role in this matter. If you actually go on to threads, articles, and things of that kind, it is very clear, very obvious, that most of the Western public actually does not understand what Western governments are doing here, and actually objects strongly to it. And I think that over time, that might start to have an effect, because however controlled political processes are in the West, it is very, very difficult to run a policy which the Western public so profoundly disagrees with. And I think that is probably, if there is going to be a shift in Western policy, that is where it will come from. The other possibility, of course, is that the Russian military campaign, which is backed by regional powers like Iran, Iraq, the Syrian government itself, becomes obviously successful, at which point, rather than avoid total humiliation, it may be that the United States and the powers that support it in Europe and in the region find that they have no realistic option but to start talking to Moscow, the alternative would be...
Let me go to Mark Slavoda here, because, you know, we all have to go back to 2003 and the illegal, irrational war against Iraq. And I'm bringing this up, gentlemen, because this is just how wrong it can go. Mark, public opinion, plus I would throw in, agreeing with Alexander here, is that the so-called American coalition is fraying right now. These there are countries in the region, they do not want to see the success of ISIS and their affiliated groups. They certainly can't do that. Jordan is very, very vulnerable here. So it is, you think it's a combination, as Alex said, public opinion and a re-jigging of the coalition?
I think the public pressure is enormously important, because we saw when Putin crafted the idea to remove Syrian chemical weapons to present an overt U.S. airstrikes in support of these, quote, rebels, unquote, it was public pressure and political pressure from the public in the U.S. Congress and the British Parliament that prevented military action. That provided the basis. Putin provided the out with the chemical weapons deal. Now, where is the U.S. anti-war movement? I mean, I know there's a Democratic president, but please wake up and see what the U.S., the CIA, the Pentagon are doing here. The U.S. taxpayers are paying the salaries of Islamist proxies to overthrow the government of a sovereign country who want to, most of which want to impose Sharia law, and they're fighting alongside or under the military banner of Al-Qaeda. Would Obama please get down on his hands and knees to the families of the victims of 9/11, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the families of the military personnel who died fighting Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Iraq, and tell them why their tax dollars are being spent to pay the salaries and buy the weapons and training of people who are fighting with or alongside Al-Qaeda?
Mark, you speak perfect logic, as you always do on this program here, but unfortunately, logic and policy don't always get along. Dima, what I'm worried about here is that Russia is doing the right thing. I think all of us in this program agree. But because of the demonization of Russia and Putin over the last couple of years, it is just simply impossible for major news outlets. I mean, you know, Putin's a brand. It's a brand, okay? Well, I mean, they get their ratings out of this kind of demonization of Russia and Putin. And how can you turn the corner on that? Because certainly, you know, Putin's looking for a way out of his isolation. That is absolutely nonsense. I mean, it's a figment of Western media's imagination.
I think the way out is public diplomacy. And look what happened. Lavrov suggested inviting 12 participants to the talks that we had just recently in
Vienna.
In Vienna, yes. Lavrov suggested that Iran, not only Iran, but also the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League, they should all participate. And the United States said no. Turkey, the Saudis, and us. So the three parties which are very much against Assad. And in secret, you know, behind the closed doors. I think what Russia should demand right now is to have an open discussion. After all, it is not just about Syria. Yep. It is about the whole region.
That's right.
So representatives of the Syrian opposition, of Mr. Assad, or of Jordan, of other countries, they should be invited. And when this is open, when there is public diplomacy, then the public opinion will start to change in the United States. In the Middle East, the public opinion
has already changed
in Russia's favor.
Alex, you know, Dima comes. You know, Dima should go to Vienna. I think he can do a good job there representing the right side of history. I mean, if you could get a more broadened format here, is this a way out for Western politicians to be able to take an about face? Because as I've pointed out over and over again, Russia is going to continued fighting and destroying terrorist infrastructure in Syria and most probably in Iraq soon. Go ahead.
Well, the way to get out of the hole is to stop digging. And that's something I think that Western leaders and political leaders, particularly in Washington, need to do. And as Mark Sloboda said, we have a situation here where the Russians are offering them a hand out. The question is whether they can find courage and the sense of humility to accept that handout and to work with the Russians and with the local forces, Iran, Iraq and the rest, to try and find a solution here. I think a solution is actually possible.
I do too.
But the problem is that there are very many people in Washington who actually do not want a solution.
Sure.
You almost feel sometimes that they would rather see the whole thing goes smash than actually find a way out.
Unfortunately, the gentleman, we've run out of time, but Alexander.
So there you have it. You see, this thing going on now is Bush belled the cat when he said that this was a crusade. He saw this as a rebirth of the crusades going into Iraq. Well, he was telling the truth. It's the same idiotic maniacs going into the Middle East now. They're doing the same thing. I mean, it's even worse now because we've got mechanized warfare and germ warfare and everything else. But it's the same old crusader mentality based on nothing. But, of course, the arms trade, making lots of money. So that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, Dave Lane's favorite day. And I hope you spread this kind of information around, because you can't get anything reasonable, logical, and intelligent off almost all American TV. It's just not there at all.